as well as more perspicuous, and agrees much better with the solemn and elevated style. Notice that it is not yet a rule per se. Louth first playfully strands a preposition himself, and it has to have been intentional. You may have heard it. He writes, "This is an idiom which our language is strongly inclined to." It's brilliant that as he talks about what our language likes to do in terms of stranding prepositions, he strands one himself. He then opines that it is more graceful, solemn, and elevated to Pied Pipe the preposition. And I get the sense that he's talking about in writing, that it's more elegant and graceful in writing, and perhaps maybe in very formal speech. From what we can tell, this opinion started to influence the usage of authors, even as some grammarians argued that sometimes the language was better served by stranding that preposition at the end of the sentence. The final nail that secured this rule in the English grammatical tradition is probably that the rule got picked up in Lindley Murray's best-selling grammar of 1795. Murray copied Louth's words, and he really did copy them, which was fairly common in these grammars. He copied Louth's words, and except that he unstranded Louth's preposition in which our language is strongly inclined to. And instead, he wrote, "This is an idiom to which our language is inclined." And I have to say, I read that and I think, where is Murray's sense of humor? Didn't he get what Louth was up to? Over time, the prescription about not stranding the preposition at the end became less about what was elegant and more about what was bad usage. In fact, there's even evidence of grammarians arguing that the natural construction in English is to Pied Pipe the preposition, which is striking to me that they're arguing that to which or about whom is the natural construction. In that scenario, the stranded preposition somehow becomes unnatural, which, as you now know, is clearly not where we started. In these early grammars, the grammarians were noting that this is an idiom that our language is inclined to. By the end of the 18th century, we find rules that state, never close a sentence with a preposition. And many people still believe this or have been taught it in school. But if you look at style guides today, you'll see that the tide may be turning on this one. You might be surprised to learn that as far back as the 1920s, H.W. Fowler, in A Dictionary of Modern English Usage, tried to make the conversation, again, about elegance rather than about a hard and fast rule about correctness. Here is Fowler, and I'm going to quote him at length here because I think this passage is wonderful and wise. Here's Fowler. "It was once a cherished superstition that prepositions must be kept true to their name and placed before the word they govern, in spite of the incurable English instinct for putting them late. The idea that," and here he quotes, "a sentence ending in a preposition is an inelegant sentence, represents what used to be a very general belief, and it is not yet dead. The fact is that the remarkable freedom enjoyed by English in putting its prepositions late and omitting its relatives is an important element in the flexibility of the language. The legitimacy of the prepositional ending in literary English must be uncompromisingly maintained in respect of elegance or inelegance. Every example must be judged not by an arbitrary rule, but on its own merits, according to the impression it makes on the feeling of educated English readers. If it were not presumptuous, after that, to offer advice, the advice would be this: follow no arbitrary rule, but remember that there are often two or more possible arrangements between which a choice should be consciously made." So there we have Fowler talking about the rule about stranded prepositions. You'll notice that Fowler actually chooses to Pied Pipe a preposition in that last sentence. He writes, two or more possible arrangements between which a choice should be consciously made. Between which. And I think that that was a good stylistic choice for Fowler. The other option would have been two or more possible arrangements which a choice should be consciously made between. That is really not particularly stylistically graceful, and Fowler opted to Pied Pipe his preposition. Fowler is giving us very wise advice here. Make stylistic choices and enjoy the freedom in English grammar that allows us to do so. Strunk and White, in the third and fourth edition of Elements of Style, give us similar advice. They say it's about having a good ear. They go on to say, years ago, students were warned not to end a sentence with a preposition. Time, of course, has softened that rigid decree. Not only is the preposition acceptable at the end, sometimes it is more effective in that spot than anywhere else. And here they provide an example. A claw hammer, not an axe, was the tool he murdered her with. This is preferable to a claw hammer, not an axe, was the tool with which he murdered her. Why? Because it sounds more violent, more like murder. A matter of ear. I love that these usage guides are giving us this kind of flexibility to trust our ear about what we're trying to achieve in a sentence. But the Microsoft Word Grammar Checker, understandably, has trouble determining when that stranded preposition is an effective stranded preposition and when it's not. And as a result, it identifies most of them. It doesn't catch all of them, but most of them. The Grammar Checker can't be that flexible. When the box pops up next to a stranded preposition, what it says is, though a preposition at the end of a sentence may be used informally, consider deleting or repositioning the preposition for a more formal or traditional tone. So it's providing some flexibility, but it suggests that it is somehow wrong in formal writing to strand the preposition. And I'm struck by the wording of, if you want a more traditional tone. But we now know that in terms of tradition, there's a long tradition of actually accepting the stranded preposition as effective sometimes. There's a story out there that Winston Churchill rejected the do not end a sentence with a preposition rule. The story goes that Churchill said, that is a silly rule up with which I will not put. Or he said, that is the sort of bloody nonsense up with which I will not put. Or he said, this is the type of errant pedantry up with which I will not put. Or, this is the sort of English up with which I will not put. Or, nonsense up with which I will not put. You can tell there are a lot of versions of the story. Ben Zimmer, executive editor of Vocabulary.com and a language columnist for the Wall Street Journal, has done some digging to find out if Winston Churchill actually said this. And it turns out that we don't have evidence that he actually did. The first instance of the quote is in the Strand magazine in 1942. Churchill contributed to the Strand, but the quote in the Strand actually cites as its source the Wall Street Journal. So here's the quote in the Strand, the citation of the Wall Street Journal, 1942. When a memorandum passed round a certain government department, one young pedant scribbled a postscript drawing attention to the fact that the sentence ended with a preposition, which caused the original writer to circulate another memorandum complaining that the anonymous postscript was offensive impertinence up with which I will not put. So the original shows up in the Wall Street Journal in 1942. By 1948, Sir Ernest Gowers wrote in plain words, It is said that Mr. Winston Churchill once made this marginal comment against a sentence that clumsily avoided a prepositional ending. This is the sort of English up with which I will not put. So we can see 6 years later, Churchill's getting credit. And Zimmer has found that in multiple newspapers, clearly it was being said that Churchill had said this. What makes the supposed Churchill quote funny is that he's playing with a phrasal verb, not a prepositional phrase. As we talked about earlier in the course, a phrasal verb is a two or three part verb with a main verb and a particle, or sometimes two, something like call up or put up with. These verbs don't like to have the particle fronted because the particle doesn't work like a preposition. So it doesn't work to say something like, with that, I will not put up, or up with that, I will not put. Instead, we say, that is something I will not put up with. This is true for other phrasal verbs. For example, we wouldn't say, up I called him, and out I asked him. They're not prepositions. I called him up. I asked him out. So remember that some of the words that look like prepositions at the end of sentences are not functioning as prepositions, and follow your judgment about when it works well and even elegantly to strand a preposition. As I bring this lecture to a close, let's take stock of where we're at now. And I very deliberately just used where we're at now, and perhaps you noticed, because I want to come full circle back to the beginning of the lecture and talk about the stigma on the question, where is X at? Where is the library at? The phrase, where we're at now, seems to work a little bit differently from the question, where's it at? Brian Garner in Modern American Usage calls where's it at uneducated, and it certainly feels informal. But Mark Lieberman, in a very interesting post on LanguageLog, shows how this expression, where we're at, appears on National Public Radio, CNN, Larry King. In other words, it appears in the speech of lots of highly educated speakers, as well as in sports interviews and sometimes in writing. For example, here is someone talking about China. And that's where we're at right now, this very fluid and precarious situation. That's where we're at right now. Would you notice if you heard that on NPR or CNN? Now, why does this happen that we get where we're at? It's about whether or not we contract. Let's step back and think about this. That's where we are, as opposed to that's where we're at. You see two phenomena interacting here. First, we like to contract. So if we have something like we are, in speech, we often like to contract to we're. But once we contract we are to we're, then we have to do something different syntactically. We need something else there at the end of the sentence. If we say, that's where we're now, it doesn't sound so good. We tend to say, that's where we're at now. I'm not recommending scattering the phrase, that's where we're at, throughout your formal writing. But I am saying that it does appear in more formal places, and including in educated speech, and we may not even notice. This whole lecture has been about stranded prepositions, and I like the description of stranded to capture the preposition left out there at the end of the clause by itself. As I've tried to capture in this lecture, that stranding can be very idiomatic. It's not inherently a bad thing. In the next lecture, we'll turn to dangling rather than stranding. We'll turn to dangling grammatical elements. Specifically, we'll talk about dangling modifiers and get in some chuckles, I think, as we contemplate the images that some of these dangling modifiers can create.
Lecture 19, The Dangers of Danglers.
I don't remember that many grammar lessons from junior high school, but for whatever reason, one sentence from the lesson about dangling and misplaced modifiers has stuck with me ever since junior high school. Here's the sentence. Clinging to the side of the aquarium, Mary saw the starfish. Poor Mary! It's exhausting to have to cling to the side of an aquarium that way. Now, of course, if we heard this sentence, we would probably assume that it was the starfish clinging to the side of the aquarium, not Mary. But if you look closely at the structure of the sentence, the participial phrase, clinging to the side of the aquarium, modifies Mary. Why? How do we know it modifies Mary? Well, the assumption is that participles and other modifiers sit next to whatever it is that they modify. So, to correct that sentence, it would need to be something more like, clinging to the side of the aquarium, the starfish stared at Mary. Or, Mary saw the starfish clinging to the side of the aquarium. The issue seems straightforward enough, but there are some twists. So I'm going to devote this entire lecture to danglers, which is what Brian Garner calls them in modern American usage. Many of these danglers are deemed unacceptable, if not ungrammatical, and we'll return to that description. And yet, some of them are acceptable, which I will explain. Let's start by talking about terminology. You may have learned these as dangling modifiers or dangling participles. Participles are a subcategory of modifiers, and the participles are often the issue. These could be present participles, those participles ending in ing, such as clinging in clinging to the side of the aquarium. Or they could be past participles with a final ed or en. Here's an example with a past participle, an example of a dangler. So listen carefully and you'll catch the dangler. Parked behind a row of tall bushes, the speeding teenagers didn't see the cop until it was too late. Now, that sentence actually doesn't make sense if you take the dangler seriously. That parked behind the tall bushes, the speeding teenagers didn't see the cop. Well, it wasn't the speeding teenagers who were hiding behind the bushes. It was the cop who was hiding behind the bushes. So we would need to have hiding behind the row of tall bushes, the cop caught the speeding teenagers. We are interested here in the participles that are acting adjectivally. Let me pause here for a moment to talk about those ing forms that are acting like nouns instead. These are called gerunds, and I know someone who claims that you can't say you know English grammar unless you can identify a gerund. So let's clarify between participles that are acting adjectivally and those ing forms that are acting like nouns, or like gerunds. You can identify a gerund by looking to see if the ing form is functioning like a noun or like a noun phrase in the sentence. Here's a straightforward example. Morgan dislikes running. You know that that running there is acting like a noun because you've got a structure, Morgan dislikes running. You expect a noun phrase right after dislikes. You've got running, so there you have a gerund. You can also get a full gerund phrase. Let's go back to our example with clinging. Let's imagine I say, clinging to the side of an aquarium is exhausting. There you can see the entire phrase, clinging to the side of an aquarium, is functioning as the subject, like a noun phrase, and then you get is exhausting. Clinging to the side of an aquarium is exhausting. Now, back to the modifiers that can be danglers. In addition to the present and past participles, you can also have modifiers that are prepositional phrases. Here's a sentence with a dangler that is a prepositional phrase. As a teacher of writing, my students often tell me about traumatic experiences they have had with grammar in high school. Did you catch the dangler? As a teacher of writing, my students often tell me. Well, of course, in that sentence, the first person I is the teacher of writing. So it would, if you wanted to get rid of the dangler, you'd have, as a teacher of writing, I often hear from students about their traumatic experiences with grammar in high school. When it comes to danglers, there can be a useful distinction between dangling modifiers or dangling participles and misplaced or wrongly attached modifiers or participles. And we're going to focus largely on participles as a subset of those modifiers. Now, some people will use dangling participle to cover all of these, but I find the distinction useful. Let's start with misplaced or wrongly attached modifiers or participles. These happen when the noun that the participle is supposed to modify is there in the sentence, just not next to the modifier. We saw this in the sentence with the starfish and clinging to the side of the aquarium, and the cop, who was in the sentence, just not next to the participle, hiding. These kinds of sentences can be really funny, and let me show you what I mean. Plummeting from the sky, Cindy watched the punted football drop right in between her son's outstretched hands. Clearly, Cindy was not plummeting from the sky. It was the punted football that was dropping from the sky, but it's kind of a wonderful image. Let's look at another one. Turning over the log with some trepidation, the spider scurried out and made little Stephen shriek. If you take this literally, assuming that the participle is modifying the noun next to it, it is the spiders that turned over the log with some trepidation. Those are clearly very strong spiders. Let's now turn to dangling modifiers, if we go with this distinction between dangling modifiers and misplaced modifiers. Dangling modifiers are dangling because there's no noun in the sentence for them to modify. So they're dangling out there without a noun or noun phrase. Examples will help here. Glancing through the document, the typos jumped off the page. Well, clearly the typos weren't glancing through the document. The narrator is glancing through the document, but the narrator is nowhere to be found in that sentence. Let me give you another example. Walking through the arboretum with my boyfriend on a beautiful April day, the birds sang uproariously, celebrating the arrival of spring. This sentence would suggest that these birds who are singing uproariously are walking through the arboretum with this person's boyfriend, which, while possible, actually seems quite unlikely. It seems much more likely that the narrator of this sentence is walking with the boyfriend, not the birds. Sometimes these danglers happen where the narrator is understood because we have an existential it. A sentence like this can sound very colloquial. Let me show you what I mean. Without knowing his name, it was difficult to introduce him. Without knowing his name, it was difficult to introduce him. Now, clearly, again, we have the narrator for whom this is a difficult situation. The narrator isn't sure how to introduce this person because the narrator doesn't know their name. But the narrator's not in the sentence. We just have, it was difficult. Here's another example. Reviewing the grades at the end of the term, it became clear that the curve needed to be adjusted. Once again, it's the narrator who's reviewing the grades, but reviewing the grades at the end of the term, it was clear. You can see how that existential it is creating a dangler. Those last one or two sentences may feel almost okay to you, or perhaps completely okay to you. And there's a good reason for that. There are some danglers that have become accepted in more formal writing. And with these, the participle has sometimes come to be accepted as a preposition, or what some would call a disguised conjunction. Here are some examples of these participles that are no longer considered dangling. Considering the danger, she is lucky to have gotten out alive. Considering the danger, she is lucky. Now, she is not the one who's considering the danger. We're all considering the danger, collectively, and as we consider the danger, we all believe that she is lucky to have gotten out alive. But that considering is now considered by many a disguised conjunction. Here's another one. Even taking all these factors into account, a team cannot win without strong defense. Once again, it's all of us who are taking these factors into account, not the team who's taking these factors into account. These participial phrases in the last two sentences are now understood to function adverbially, modifying the whole sentence with an understood we who are considering or taking factors into account. In that way, these participial phrases function like sentence adverbs, which we've talked about before, sentence adverbs like mercifully, or now for many of us, hopefully. Which participles can do this, can act like disguised conjunctions and function adverbially? These would be participles such as according, assuming, concerning, considering, given, judging, regarding, owing to, speaking. And let me give you a couple of examples with speaking. Here's the first. Roughly speaking, a new edition is published every 10 to 20 years. Roughly speaking, a new edition. Well, the new edition isn't speaking at all. It's all of us, roughly speaking, are saying, or the narrator, roughly speaking, is saying, a new edition is published every 10 to 20 years. Or, here's a very colloquial one. Speaking of politics, what is going on with this election? Speaking of politics, what? Who's speaking of politics? We're speaking of politics. As I said, you can feel how colloquial that kind of sentence is. H.W. Fowler, in his usage guide, raised the interesting question of when this kind of participle becomes accepted as a disguised conjunction or a preposition. How would we know? Here's the example that he provides to raise the question. Referring to your letter, you do not state, blah, blah, blah. Referring to your letter, you do not state. Well, the person who says the sentence is the person who's referring to the letter. It's not you, it's your letter. So in theory, maybe it needs to be, referring to your letter, I find that you do not state, blah, blah, blah. But is referring to your letter now functioning adverbially? Is referring now one of those disguised conjunctions so that we can say it's not dangling, it's just sitting there like considering the danger, referring to your letter? How would I answer that? Well, what I did was go to the Corpus of Contemporary American English. I looked in the academic subsection to see what's going on in academic prose, and I searched for those initial referring to participial phrases. What I found is that almost all of those initial referring to phrases have the relevant noun right after the phrase. For example, referring to X, the author argues. So there you're seeing referring to X, the author, it's the author who's referring to X. But when I was in the corpus, I did find exceptions. For example, referring to figure 2, the presence of the safety provisions shifts the demand curve up. Well, the safety provisions are not what is referring to figure 2. The author of the article is referring to figure 2 or asking all of us as readers to refer to figure 2. That would suggest that that referring to there is functioning like a disguised conjunction. So right now, usage suggests, if I take my search seriously, that referring to remains largely a modifier as opposed to a disguised conjunction. At least editors are treating it that way. But it's not confusing to say, referring to figure 2, the data suggest. If I were asked on the usage ballot whether or not it was acceptable to use referring to as a disguised conjunction, I would not say that it was unacceptable. I would probably vote somewhat acceptable because you can find the examples there in edited prose, but you find more examples where referring to is being treated as a modifier with the modifying noun right after it. All our examples have had the participial phrase at the beginning of the sentence. Brian Garner in Modern American Usage points out that editors are often more lenient about these phrases at the end of sentences. Here's his example. Sarah stepped to the door looking for her friend. It's hard to call this unacceptable. It's very clear that Sarah is doing both actions. Garner calls these kinds of participles coordinating participles because they imply that the verb happened next. In other words, Sarah stepped to the door and looked for her friend. Here's another example. My colleague wrote an email to me after our meeting asking if he had unintentionally insulted me by joking about marathon runners. Again, you can see, sent me an email and asked. It's doing that kind of coordinating work. But technically in the sentence, asking is coming after our meeting. He sent me the email after our meeting asking. As I said, danglers are not a totally cut and dried issue. And I'm struck by a line in Brian Garner's usage guide in which he writes, most danglers are ungrammatical. What he means is that somehow if a participial phrase at the beginning of a sentence is not followed by the noun it is supposed to modify, the sentence is ungrammatical. But let's think again about the sentence, without knowing his name, it was difficult to introduce him. Is that ungrammatical to you? With a sentence like that, do we understand the sentence? Does our grammar in the descriptive sense allow participial phrases and other modifiers to be separated from the noun or even to exist without the noun they modify? Clearly the answer is yes. And as Garner notes, we are more forgiving when the participial phrase is at the end of the sentence. We remain stricter when it is at the beginning of the sentence. And as I've said, there are good reasons to avoid ambiguity in writing, that you aren't there to clarify. And so you want to make sure that people know that Mary's not clinging to the side of the aquarium and the speeding teenagers aren't hiding behind the tall row of bushes. But I'm reluctant to say that these sentences with danglers are mostly ungrammatical. That doesn't feel right to our experience with these sentences. There's a key difference here between speech and writing. These sentences are usually easy to parse in speech. We go with logic. We know what's what. We know that it's the starfish clinging to the side of the aquarium and that Cindy is not plummeting from the sky. It's the football. As I said, in writing, we need to be more careful because we can't be there to clarify if the ambiguity comes up, and we want to make sure that our readers understand exactly what we mean. So should you be careful about this in writing? Yes. When you edit more formal writing, check those modifiers that start sentences to see what comes right after the modifier, remembering that some ing modifiers like considering and regarding are now considered exceptions. Speaking of editing, did you catch what I just did there? I want to point out that ambiguity around modifiers doesn't have to be about a dangling modifier. The modifier can technically be in the right place and still be ambiguous in a way that merits rewriting. This issue hit my radar in a very funny way. In legal writing, where writers are supposed to be so careful about exactly this kind of thing. And this story is good enough that I just had to share it. My sister, who's a lawyer, sent me a provision from the New Jersey Administrative Code. She and her husband were trying to deal with the squirrels in the attic, and so she had checked the regulation. The relevant regulation is NJAC, the New Jersey Administrative Code, 7.25-5.21, which is titled, and I've left out the Latin names for the animals in the title, but here's the title, squirrel, raccoon, opossum, skunk, weasel, woodchuck, coyote, gray fox, and red fox damage. I'm going to read you the first provision. See if you can spot the ambiguity given how this sentence is phrased. Property owners and occupants of dwellings suffering damage from squirrel, raccoon, opossum, skunk, weasel, woodchuck, gray fox, red fox, and coyote, or their agents designated in writing, may control these animals by lawful procedures at any time, subject to state law and local ordinances. Did you spot it? If you did, how can you not giggle? I started picturing a woodchuck with a little notarized affidavit. After all, we're talking about these animals or their agents designated in writing. My first reaction was that there must be a misplaced modifier here, which allows any or all of these critters to have agents designated in writing. Mary and the starfish jumped to mind. When you look closely at the sentence, though, the phrase, or their agents designated in writing, is not dangling or misplaced. There is a legitimate reading of the sentence where it stands as an alternative to property owners and occupants of dwellings suffering damage. Yet, this sentence desperately needs an editor. Let's read through it again. Property owners and occupants of dwellings. Okay, so there's the subject. And now we're going to get a modifier of those dwellings. Suffering damage from squirrel, raccoon, opossum, skunk, weasel, woodchuck, gray fox, and red fox, and coyote. So again, that's a modifying ing phrase describing the dwellings that may have suffered damage from this wide range of critters. We can now continue with the sentence. Or their agents designated in writing. Now this refers back to the property owners or occupants who are in the damaged dwellings, but it's been a while since we saw that subject, which is why we may think it's the critters who have the agents designated in writing. And then we go on with the sentence and have, may control these animals. The length of the prepositional phrase from squirrel, raccoon, blah, 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 and coyote stretches readers' working memory dangerously far, loading a lot of information in between the subject noun phrase, the property owners and occupants of dwellings, and the appositive phrase, or their agents designated in writing. You can't blame us for wanting to attach the agents to the critters. There are some other potential issues. For example, the and between the red fox and the coyote and the omission of an Oxford comma after red fox in the list of animals also potentially raise questions of whether all of these critters need to be working in cahoots for the regulation to apply, whether it is only the red fox and the coyote who are working together, or whether all of the animals can be independent, free agent damage doers. Lawyers think about these kinds of things. In addition, the there in or their agents is ambiguous, even if grammatically unproblematic. My sister, the attorney, explained the kinds of questions that lawyers could raise in a legal context in response to this passage. She sent me a wonderful email. She writes, for example, suppose a coyote wished to transfer its right to chew through the insulation, including, but not limited to, associated electrical wiring, to a field mouse by means of a limited durable power of attorney. Would the coyote need to get the permission of each other animal in order for that power of attorney to be effective? Similarly, what if a squirrel, having no present use for such, wished to assign its interest in improperly locked garbage cans to a raccoon and a black bear by means of a general agency agreement? Could the squirrel assign its interests separate and apart from the interests of others, or can specific rights and interests only be assigned collectively? It's a mess. A mess indeed. Here we see why written language, and especially legal language, can require a level of attention to modifiers and commas unlike more informal writing, and certainly more than speech. with legal documents we cannot get away with, but that's not what I meant. I want to close this lecture by talking briefly about a construction that can look like a dangling participle, but it is instead what is called an absolute construction. Here's a very common one. Weather permitting, the race will start at 8 a.m. Weather permitting. The whole phrase, in this case, weather permitting, functions adverbially. It functions like, if the weather permits. These absolute constructions will often have a noun and a participle. We saw it there with weather permitting. It could be a present participle. Here are a few other examples. This being the case, again, we see the noun, this, or this, in this case, a pronoun, plus the participle, being. Or here's another one. The sun having risen, we jumped into the lake. Or you could have an absolute construction with a past participle. For example, all things considered. Being that has been controversial among grammarians. When is it okay because it is an absolute construction? And when is it not okay because it means because or since? Here it is in an absolute construction. The review criticized the book for taking a more philosophical than empirical approach, the implication being that the author strayed too far from the data. There we see the implication being that in an absolute construction. Compare that to this sentence. Being that the condo development was just built, it does not appear on most maps. There, the being that means because the condo development was just built. What do you think of this sentence? Being that it's a holiday, I let the kids sleep late. Does that sound okay to you? 71% of the American Heritage Dictionary usage panel rejected that sentence as somewhat or completely unacceptable. What about this sentence? Being that he has never attended law school, it's strange that he's giving legal advice. 83% of the panel rejected that one. Clearly, being that, meaning because or since, is not held in high regard right now, at least in these more formal contexts. Let's return for a moment to the absolute construction with being that. One thing my colleagues and I are seeing in student writing is the being that absolute construction becoming its own sentence. Ryan McCarty, who's pursuing his PhD at Michigan, has been looking into this. And he's found these absolute constructions with being that as their own sentence in published writing too, although it is criticized. Here's an example from 2009 in an issue of the Journal of Instructional Psychology. It reads, "There are a plethora of reasons to be given for the importance of social studies." Period. A major reason being that threats to humanity exist if nations continually spend excessive amounts of money on the military as well as plan attacks against each other. Clearly, we have a fragment here with being. We could put in an is instead and correct the issue. In speech, we'd never notice because no one would do what I did, which is say, period, to indicate that the first sentence had ended. Instead, we could imagine that there was a dash or even a comma so that the being that sentence was part of the being that phrase was part of the sentence. In writing, absolute constructions, when they are not fragments, have their benefits. They can be a nice way to vary one's sentence structure. The sun having risen, we jumped into the lake versus the sun rose and we jumped into the lake. Just beware of making those absolute constructions into their own sentence in formal writing. This last example highlights the question of how we package information we want to present. How do we package it grammatically? In an absolute construction, such as the sun having risen, or in an independent clause, the sun rose? Or Do we want that idea at the end of the sentence? We jumped into the lake after the sun rose. What would help us decide which version of the sentence works best in a passage of writing? We can answer that. In the next lecture, we'll discuss in more detail how we can structure information in sentences and paragraphs to avoid what is colloquially known as choppiness.
Lecture 20, Navigating the Choppy Paragraph.
It's time to put together a lot of the grammatical pieces we've been talking about into the bigger picture of how we present information in our writing. In this lecture, I will provide a few fundamental pieces of advice about how to help your readers follow your ideas by helping your readers follow you from sentence to sentence. We're going to see some real payoff for understanding how sentences work in terms of subjects and predicates, conjunctive adverbs, relative clauses, and the like. There are some wonderfully concrete ways that you can help make your prose clearer and make it, quote unquote, flow through your syntactic choices. Now, there's a reason I said, quote unquote, flow. Flow is not actually a very useful word to describe writing, although we use it all the time. I have a colleague at Michigan who says, rivers flow, writing does not flow. What does flow mean? That the verb comes right after the subject? Well, of course the verb comes right after the subject. We're trying to capture something about how sentences relate to sentences. The opposite is that your writing is choppy. And I have to admit that I'm guilty of saying this to students about writing. But a student, when told that their writing is choppy, asks, well, how do I fix choppy writing? Which is a completely fair question. In this lecture, we'll address exactly that choppiness question. How do you make your writing less choppy? In order to do this, we'll need to talk about where we place the weight in the sentence. And here I'm talking about weight in the sense of content. Where are we introducing a lot of new information? And weight in the sense of the sheer number of words in different elements of a sentence. What helps readers to follow along as we write? What helps them process the information that we are presenting? With that question, let's return to choppy. What are we saying? Somehow, as a reader, if we're experiencing writing as choppy, we're having trouble seeing connections between sentences. Somehow, our expectations as readers are not being met. We're reading along and expecting one thing, and then we get something else. And so our head metaphorically jerks up. What? Why is that right there? Where is this passage going? This raises the key question, how can you know as a writer what your readers are expecting? And how can you help them navigate your prose? I'm going to give you some very specific answers to those questions. One answer is about how you use conjunctive adverbs or adverb phrases, which we discussed in an earlier lecture. Conjunctive adverbs are words like therefore, nonetheless, consequently, and phrases like in addition or in sum. These adverbs help us as readers understand how one sentence is connected to the next. As writers, they can help us prepare our readers for what is coming. That said, just to use a conjunctive adverbial, you know right now that I'm about to provide a counter or a caveat because I just said, that said. That said, there is a more fundamental principle at work in terms of how we can present information sentence to sentence in a way that makes sense to readers. It is often called the known new contract or the given new contract. What I love about this concept is that it is not rocket science. It is actually very intuitive, and it can be completely revelatory about what is not working in a passage of writing. Here's the fundamental idea. As readers, we expect the information we know to precede new information. Grammatically, how that works is that known information will appear in subject position, and new information will appear in the predicate. Or, known information will be in an introductory phrase, an adverbial, for example, such as, given that. As an aside here, you can see the way this known new or given new contract plays out in tables in publications in English and other languages that read from left to right. As readers, as I just talked about, we tend to expect the context or information we know in the subject, which in an English sentence is to the left, and new information to the right. In tables, you will often see context or old information in left-hand columns and information to pay attention to in right-hand columns. It's something to think about as you design your own tables. Let's now return to how the known new contract plays out in prose. Examples from real writing will help here. Let's start with a straightforward example from the book Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown. This passage is just two sentences, and we're going to look at how the information is structured within these two sentences. Here we go. Since early in the 18th century, the London watermen had also made a sport of racing their dories in impromptu competitions. They were rough and tumble events. Let's now look at how the information is structured. The first sentence introduces the impromptu competitions in the predicate. The second sentence then tells us about those competitions, using the they that refers back to the competitions. The competitions are now known information, and they get picked up in the second sentence in known position, and then we learn something new about them in the predicate of the second sentence. Let's now look at a longer passage, this one from the book The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. Here, we're going to look at five consecutive sentences. And as context for this passage, let me just note that HeLa cells are the cells that were derived from the cervical cancer cells extracted from Henrietta Lacks in 1951. They were the first human cells grown in a lab that were immortal. Here's the passage. Again, this is five sentences. Researchers had long believed that human cells contained 48 chromosomes, the threads of DNA inside cells that contain all our genetic information. But chromosomes clump together, making it impossible to get an accurate count. Then, in 1953, a geneticist in Texas accidentally mixed the wrong liquid with HeLa and a few other cells, and it turned out to be a fortunate mistake. The chromosomes inside the cells swelled and spread out, and for the first time, scientists could see each of them clearly. The accidental discovery was the first of several developments that would allow the researchers, two researchers from Spain and Sweden, to discover that normal human cells have 46 chromosomes. Okay, let's now unpack how the information is presented in these five sentences. The first sentence, researchers believed there were 48 chromosomes in human cells. All right, so now we've set the context. The second sentence, but chromosomes clumped together. We as readers are prepared to be talking about chromosomes, which have been introduced and explained in the first sentence. And now we know something new about them. They clump together, so they can't be counted accurately. Moving on to the third sentence. Then, in 1953. That then prepares us as readers for the introduction of new information right there. And we're going to get that new information in subject position, but we're ready. This geneticist in Texas who appears out of nowhere, but we're prepared because we had that then. So we're not actually surprised to see the geneticist who accidentally mixes the wrong liquid in with some cells. Now the fourth sentence. The chromosomes inside the cells, well, we were just talking about those cells and their chromosomes, so we're prepared to learn something new about them. They swelled and spread out. Now the fifth sentence. This accidental discovery was... This accidental discovery sums up what we've just been talking about and then tells us the implications of the accidental discovery that two researchers from Spain and Sweden discovered that normal human cells have only 46 chromosomes. To sum up, the passage is easy to follow, in part because our expectations are met as we go in terms of how each sentence presents the information. We don't have to work too hard as readers in terms of how the information is structured, so we can focus on the story that the sentences are telling. What I'm trying to capture is this. Each sentence creates expectations for what's going to come next. As readers, we don't read with a completely open mind, equally happy to see whatever the author is going to talk about next. As we read, we make predictions, and we can be thrown when our predictions or our expectations for what's going to come next are not met. Let me show you what I mean. Let's take these sentences from an article in The Atlantic called "To Remember a Lecture Better, Take Notes by Hand." It was published in May of 2014. This passage is four sentences long. A new study conducted by Mueller and Oppenheimer finds that people remember lectures better when they've taken handwritten notes rather than typed ones. Adolescents these days suffer from short attention spans. The educational system must respond to new technologies. Perhaps it is time to bring back the pencil. All right, let's step back and look at that passage. Things are jumping around here. Handwritten notes are introduced in the first sentence. Adolescence and short attention spans come in the next sentence. Then we get educational reforms due to new technologies. And then at the very end, we go back to handwritten notes. Okay, it's time for me to be honest. This passage is choppy because I rewrote it to make it choppy. Let's look at what I did and then what the real article does. Let's take the first sentence, which is real. This one actually is in the article. A new study conducted by Mueller and Oppenheimer finds that people remember lectures better when they've taken handwritten notes rather than typed ones. Where do you, as a reader, expect the passage to go next? I would guess that you're thinking about possibilities such as handwriting. We're going to talk more about handwriting. Or we're going to talk more about typing. Or we're going to talk about more details from this particular study. Where did we go instead? Well, the next sentence was about adolescents and their attention spans. It's clearly related, but nothing in this second sentence actually picks up information in the first sentence to make it given information in the second sentence. So the second sentence is, adolescents these days suffer from short attention spans. Now what are your expectations for the next sentence? Perhaps what causes these short attention spans, or the effects of them? What actually follows? This sentence, the educational system must respond to new technologies. We're smart readers, and we'll try to connect the dots. Okay, so we were just talking about attention spans, so maybe that's linked to the new technologies, but the sentence actually starts with educational reform, and new technologies is not actually linked to the attention spans explicitly. We can make it work, but readers are having to do a lot of work here. the passage introduces information and then seems not to follow through because things don't get clearly picked up in the next sentence of the passage. As a result, the passage feels choppy and not fully satisfying. What does the actual article do? Okay, here's the actual passage from the article, which you're going to see is much better than my version. A new study conducted by Mueller and Oppenheimer finds that people remember lectures better when they've taken handwritten notes rather than typed ones.